Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, Voices from the Irish Life and Lore series. I'm Maurice O'Keefe. Hoat Castle in North County Dublin has been lived in by the Lawrence family for over 800 years. And sadly, all that came to an end recently when Christopher Gatesford St. Lawrence passed away. Provisions had been left for him by the new owners who had bought it in 2018, for Christopher and his wife Merle to continue living there until he died. Now, sadly, it's come to an end of an era and a great loss to the state. To tell the story, I spoke to Christopher Gatesford St. Lawrence, and I also spoke to his son Julian. I also spoke to Christopher's wife Merle, and we start with Merle talking about her past. Her marriage to Christopher was not the first time that a Guinness had married into the St. Lawrence family.
And there's a wonderful picture there, because when I married Christopher, Julian was very nice about it, and he said, well, Merle, not the first time the Guinness family had married into the St. Lawrence's. And we've got out the photograph, and it's marvellous. But that was one of the brewing Guinnesses marrying the last Earl of Hoath's daughter. Yes. Well, actually, the third Earl of Hoath's daughter, not quite the last one, but that was the story there.
Your own upbringing, you were brought, as you say, from the age of 15, you were educated.
Well, I just left my main school in England. I just left that. And then I was sent to, naturally, like the sort of thing one was, to a civilising school in London, you know, that sort of thing. And then I think I had nearly a year in Paris. It was another world, wasn't it? Another world.
But you, I suppose you were brought up privileged.
Very.
To I mean, looking back on it, very. To have the opportunities.
Very. I mean, it was. Then I wanted to read social science in Trinity, and my father wouldn't let me. And I think he was right. Mm. Well, he said, the first thing is your voice will finish you. You see, you spoke with an English voice like that. You hadn't really a faintest idea. You saw the terrible poverty in Dublin. You won't remember that, but I remember it. Appalling. Yeah. And we were shocked. I was shocked rigid. I was absolutely shocked rigid. No child had children's clothes on. They had the father's sort of jacket, which was, came down to there. Mm. And they were. It was so sad. And it was huge families. You saw them in York Street particularly, because that was the sort of time we came in on that, and it was terrible. And anyway, but I think he was right, because you see, social science was more than just, you know, doing the university course. It was, which is what I wanted to do, was to go into the slums and try and help.
In 2014, when I visited Hoat Castle to meet Merle Gatesford St. Lawrence, I spoke to her at great length there about her father's experiences during the Great War. And she also mentioned that there were three members of the Lawrence family from Hoat Castle who also were involved in the Great War.
Three from this house alone. Three young men from this house went to that war. She said they'd all been at school in England. To a man. Not one of them had been to school, I would say. Not one of them had been to school here. I'm sure they hadn't. Because even we were sent to school in England. That was a different outlook on life.
What, was education in this country not good enough?
It wasn't. It was considered too parochial, I think. And it was tough. It was very tough. I mean, for my only son was sent over, against my wishes very much, because my father, having been sent over as a small boy, first to Summerfields and then to Eton, said, don't send him. Don't send him. There's no need now. The schools are good here. You know, there's no need to send him. And my first husband said, oh, he had to go. But all his contemporaries were still going. That would be in 1965. Yeah. It was still going to England.
At that time?
At that time.
Imagine, yeah.
That's all stopped now completely, I think. Mm-hmm. But my brother's two boys are all educated in England. Mm-hmm. It was a feeling, I suppose, of perhaps like India, really, sort of an empire. Still the feeling it was there. Still the feeling of British loyalty. I do remember a slight sort of hiccup when Costello came back from Canada and said we were no longer in the Commonwealth. And that was, for our sort of families, a slight hiccup, I think. It was very difficult to be a republic. And yet, all the English relations who wrote letters, you know, I really feel that now is the moment when you can no longer continue to live in Ireland.
So that Anglo-Irish
tag is quite strong. And my father said, well, I was born here, and I'm going to die. He was very keen about the dying. And so we stayed. And most people stayed. There wasn't an exodus at that stage. The big exodus had happened in 1921, hadn't it? Mm-hmm. Huge numbers of people went. And there was another exodus, really, when the wealth tax happened. That hit people, mostly Americans. That was a big mistake.
Yeah.
And my best friend was Mrs. Hexter. She was the Hertz car millionaires. She employed 11 people outside on 300 acres. She had another 5 or 6 employed in the house. Look at that for employment. Mm. And Richie Ryan manages to... She said, I can't stay. I can't afford it.
I visited Christopher Gatesford St. Lawrence in the wing of the castle in a cold January day in 2020, after the castle had been sold.
The St. Lawrence is very... It's associated with this area, this place, for something like 800 years.
Yeah, I agree.
Norman... But the Gatesfords, where?
They were in the Wiltshire family, and my great grandfather married a St. Lawrence daughter. Simple as that.
Yes. So, but
so he, my grandfather, inherited from his maternal uncle. But don't think the uncle thought of them as an English family. They were a Wiltshire family, straight.
Does that change things?
I brought up more as St. Lawrence in ways, but my father was brought up as a Gatesford. When I'm talking as if I was a St. Lawrence, not a Gatesford.
Tell me about your two aunts.
I had a bachelor uncle.
Tom, yes.
And one of the aunts, his sisters, would be here at Hove being... doing the duties of a wife, shall we say, just looking after the cook and everything else, running the house.
Christopher was only 10 years old when the Second World War broke out, and his father was involved, so he spent a lot of the war years in Hoth, and in 1955 he inherited the castle. And he talks here about running the farm himself.
Where was the income coming from to keep the whole place going?
A combination of ground rents and the farm income. You know what I mean? Simple as that. Well, I was very happy being a farmer. I mean, ground rents came in and you had an agent who looked after that. But I mean, there was a farm here. There were 120 milking cows always. A dairy, we delivered milk. We were farming at that stage about 400 acres. And you had the milk grounds, and you all needed organizing. It wasn't in the best of condition. It hadn't been very well organized for the previous 5-6 years, because my uncle had lost interest and was devoting and killed himself working for the Knights of Malta and the ambulance corps, which he started. And therefore, the farm was getting into the steward of the farm was a beef farmer, and it was a dairy herd. And he was a very honest and straight man, but he was not the person who should have been steward.
I see. And did he stay, or did you let him go, or who was he? Who was this man?
There was a man called Barrister, and he came from Westmeath when he was a Westmeath farming family. And he, very sadly, soon after I arrived, well, I think he had it when I arrived, he had, I'll call it the drunken disease. He didn't drink. But if you saw him walking along the street, and I know he was hauled up on one or two occasions, he walked as if he was drunk.
Oh, I see.
He couldn't walk. I mean, I'll call it the drunken disease. It's got some official name. But if you saw him walking down the street, you would have thought he was drunk. Going all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
But he hadn't probably got a drop of alcohol on him.
Oh, that was
unfortunate,
really.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. I mean,
who was the agent here in your time then?
I don't think, in the traditional sense, we didn't have an agent here. The farm steward ran the farm. He was the steward. Yeah. And then the head gardener, there was a commercial garden here. There were over 20 people at one stage employed in the garden, and nurseries and tomato houses. And the farm had around 20. And the farm in 1932 had been the most modern farm in Ireland, without a doubt, dairy. And there was...
What was the breed of cattle?
Friesians and Jerseys.
Yes.
And it was a lot of the... There were learners, because there were... as good as know if any agricultural colleges. And a lot of the stewards of the 1960s around the country had been taught as learners here.
So it was like a little school.
Hope Domain Dairy. But my uncle was extraordinary to the extent that he was extremely efficient. When his mind was on it, and he got a very modern dairy going, etc., and we delivered milk, etc., bottled it. When he had got it going, he left it to the steward, really, and then concentrated on the gardens. Well, then, after he concentrated on the gardens, which he never really finished and never really got going, other than it won prizes in RDS and Christ knows what, he never really got it going as a commercial enterprise. He, at that stage, he paid no attention to the farm, really.
And then
his mind went on to the Knights of Malta, and he paid no attention to either. We definitely sold land near Sutton, 1965, a building estate went up. The majority of the people who owned Uffington Park houses were airline pilots, that type of person, you know what I mean? And that was farmland, which I sold off for building. And it was on ground rent, in fact, because it brought in more income. We end at St. Anne's.
Oh, yes.
St. Anne's was home estate.
Yeah.
And then from St. Anne's to here, you can say it was home estate.
Fascinating
but
property to have at that time.
No, but the home estate was a very big estate. But, and probably the worst of it was Hove when it came to farming. The golf course was more luck than anything else. The golf course, people were saying that I ought to have tea rooms for the rhododendrons. And I couldn't see any point in putting up a building. I put up a car park, but I couldn't see any point in putting up a building which was for 3 month season.
Yes.
And so there's one bit of land around the reservoir which was suitable for a short golf course. And so I decided that if I built the tea rooms, I'd build a building which also did the short golf course. I don't think we were in the county then. I think we were in the corporation still. And there were two roads pointing into the field in front of the house.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't, and I knew more about golf then because I had looked at the municipal courses in the Croydon district. And you didn't have to get planning permission for a golf course then. So I immediately built a golf course, stopped building the par three, and immediately started building a golf course in front of the house to stop it being built on. I mean, I didn't want the council house estate to come into this field, literally there, and to come up to the moat. And so I built a golf course to stop.
Stop development coming in. Towards, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you were
and
successful.
And I reckon I would have had a lot of signatures behind that thing when they tried to acquire it, saying no.
Yeah.
We want it as a golf course.
So for all those reasons, were you happy that the golf course did, was developed there?
Oh, very, because I didn't know it at the time. I then put up a building, which was turned out to be far too small. And I expected the thing to turn over and to make a little money. I was not expecting it to be a loss. I was expecting it, but I wasn't expecting it. What happened? We opened the golf course in May 73, 9 holes. And 50,000 people played the first year.
You've come to an end of an era here. Obviously, it's very sad and to see it all going. How do you feel yourself? Do you think that...
At this stage, yeah. I say no comment.
Or even...
I'm going to make no comment on the present situation.
Okay. And so, but that tells me that you were very attached to this place all your life. 70 years, I think, since you first came over and took on the reins. But you'll see your days out here. Is that am I right in saying that?
I'm going to live in this house until I die.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. Listen, it was a pleasure, and thank you so much for talking to me again, indeed.
I'm in Coolcarrigan in Kildare, and I'm talking to Julian Gatesford, St. Lawrence. You grew up in Hoat, in the castle.
I was brought up there. I was educated in England, and then went to university in England and did 20 years in the, roughly 20 years in the city as a fund manager, and then came back in 1999 when my father was 70 and was allegedly going to step down and hand everything over to me, which he did to an extent, but not 100%. So I've spent the first 20 years of my life there and the last 20 years of my life and intervening 20 years basically in London.
So what does it mean to you, the history, the background to the St. Lawrence's and the castle and 800 years of history?
It means a lot. I think it's a tribute to Ireland that one family should have managed to remain in the same place for over 800 years undisturbed, essentially. The house itself has become increasingly impractical, and it's large. It's over 30,000 square feet, and we ended up finding that one couple over 60 and one couple over 80 were rattling around inside the thing, and there comes a point when, in some way, the house itself is taking over your life rather than you controlling your life yourself.
At the time, your granduncle, Tom, isn't it, was in the castle and
Well, he when my great-grandfather died in the early 30s.
Yes.
Tom inherited the castle. He had a career in... he was in the Seaforth Highlanders during the First World War. He won an MC with two bars, and there were about 30,000 MCs in the First World War, I think... 600 VCs, and I think about 130 people won an MC with two bars. So he was basically suicidally brave, had some sort of breakdown after the war, and was never expected to marry. Quite possibly he was gay. If he was gay, he certainly wasn't actively gay. He ran the estate in sort of fairly Edwardian style until he died in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that he'd cut down enormously from the close to 30 gardeners they had before the Second World War, to when he cut back to about 10 or 12 afterwards.
I see, yes. And did you live long enough, or did he live long enough for you to know him?
No, he died in 1955. My grandfather, who'd been a naval officer through both World Wars, died in September 57, and I was born in 2 months later in November.
Oh, I see.
So I didn't know either of them. I knew my My grandmother, who survived into the 1980s, but my father's mother.
Your father's mother.
Mary Claire, yeah.
And so what was she like?
Oh, she was she was quite engagingly vague in some ways, but she was very child-friendly. She kept tins of sweets and that sort of stuff to lure her grandchildren around.
Yes.
And she lived in the wing of the house that my father's in at the moment.
Oh, I see. Yes.
When my grandfather retired from the Navy, he came back to Hove, and his brother was running the main house, and he lived in the wing that we call Tower House.
I see.
For the last 10 years or so of his life, but when Tom died, the estate essentially went straight to my father, because my grandfather had no wish in his mid-60s to take over running the place.
Okay, and your father was very young when he did take it over. He was only 25.
Well, there was my father was in the had a commission in the army, in the British Army, in the Scots Greys, which had been commanded by his uncle, and it took him sort of a year and a half or so to extricate himself from that responsibility.
At the time, there was a dairy going, there was a market gardening going, so he inherited all of this, didn't he?
Well, there would have been there was a farm manager, and he would have basically run the thing on a day-to-day basis, and the garden was under a head gardener called Mr. Russell, who I can vaguely remember from my very early youth. But fairly soon after my father took over, he cut back quite severely on the amount of gardening staff and that sort of thing that there was.
Those early memories of yours, what do you remember about how things were working, how things were going there?
Well, I can remember I was brought up in a nursery with a quite severe and I think somewhat disappointed spinster from Galway, who was our nanny, who I think possibly missed a vocation as a nun. But
after Julian finished his education, he went to London, and in 1998 he returned to Hote Castle and Estate to take over the management there. What was it like working with your father, relationship wise? Was it easy?
Well, I didn't particularly work with him. I did do between school and university. I did 2 or 3 months working for him, and doing farm accounts and various other things that in the spring, I suppose, of 1976. And that convinced me that it would be better that we didn't work together. When I came back, he, about 6 months later, stepped down from any day-to-day involvement in running things, and he sort of concentrated on things like he did a lot of work in the woods and that sort of thing. He's always been keen on on that. So the only things that I was, you know, involved with him were, you know, strategic decisions that we might take rather than day-to-day
decisions.
Yeah. And it was quite a... We're employing about 60 people. You know, it was a 80-bedroom hotel, so there were layers of management, you know, at that time. Because the hospitality industry is quite labour-intensive.
Okay. So, you know, as the years rolled on then, the business, how was it going? Was it... You know, certainly the early 90s and the boom years, you must have been doing very well.
Well, in the early 90s, my father was running it, that was probably the period when the golf was generating the most money. The 90s went on, certain number of golf courses opened in competition. So the days when we had people queuing on, they started queuing on Friday night in order to go out on Saturday morning. People took it in turns to spend the night in a car in a car park. Happened in the 1990s, courses opening in competition, you know, reduced that. Business in, you know, the early 2000s was comfortably profitable without having quite the same numbers on the golf course as had been the case previously.
All right, so I suppose your decision to sell it, that only happened quite recently.
We were approached by a company called Tetrarch who run Mount Juliet, bought and sold the Pars Court hotel.
Were you dealing with one particular person, or with the whole company, or who makes up?
The managing director of Tetrarch is a guy called Michael McGillicuddy, who lives Yeomanstown, not far from here, and he was the principal person that we were
dealing with,
it was it took the best part of a year and a half. Well, it took a year and a half to. You know, to actually shape the deal, and then for them to find the finance for the deal, and then complete it.
The stipulation being that your father could live in the place until he died.
No, we had a. Decision to make about the house, because the wing in which I moved back is essentially a comfortable, manageable five bedroom house, is quite separate from the main part of the house with the main rooms. There's only one connecting door at the moment. I thought about keeping that permanently. I mean, not including it in the sale, which I could perfectly well have negotiated without any great problem. But I decided that if we weren't going to be running the estate, but probably 90% of the things that Tetrarch did would be fine as far as I was concerned, and 10% would really irritate me. Looking out the window and getting irritated didn't seem to be a terribly clever overall strategy. What we decided to do instead was my father made it clear that he's been at Hoef since 1957, and it was his parents' home for 10 years before that, he wanted to go out of the house in a box. So we took a 20-year lease on the wing, given that that's that he's 89 at the moment, we reckon that will probably see him out. Not guaranteed, but the likelihood is that it will.
Yeah.
So
yourself and your wife Anne, then you've moved down here to County Kildare, very much downsizing.
We've bought a house, which is called Castle Size, which actually we've renamed Castle Downsize, which is still quite a large house. We'll need an awful lot of work doing to it.
Yeah.
But we'll be able to take quite a large amount of the furniture and pictures and stuff that's at Hoef at the moment.
Oh, yes. All the family heirlooms.
All of them, but a substantial number of them. We were fortunate in that Sheila Wilson Wright died during the summer. John, her ex-husband, was my godfather, and I've known Rob and Anna all my life. So they asked us if we'd, at Sheila's funeral, as it happens, if we'd take this house, and it works very well because we can stay here.
It's a stepping stone.
As long as it takes to get Castle Size back into shape.
Yeah. Julian Gatesford St. Lawrence, thank you so much for talking to me. And I know it wasn't easy, but thank you very much indeed.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to clips taken from interviews carried out with Christopher Gatesford St. Lawrence, who sadly passed away recently, to his wife, Meryl, and also to Christopher's son, Julian. All these interviews are available on our designated oral history website. That's irishlifeandlore.com. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and thank you for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.